all sprang forward. Got to the zendo on time, more or less. And apparently, apparently on the website it says 8 o'clock.
Yes, I missed that this morning.
So one brand new, an hour early. But back, so that's good. So we're all here, and I thought I'd. Since today we're going to talk about, we're going to recite the Bodhisattva precepts, which we do once a month on the full moon, approximately on the full moon. So I thought I'd talk about a precept today, and I thought I'd talk about truth and lies. The precept of not speaking falsely. The 20th century Japanese haiku poet Santoka was a Soto Zen monk, and he was also a wanderer, something of a maverick. He never stayed put and practiced at a temple for long. He had a drinking problem, as we say, and he was often ill. But he wrote a wonderful haiku. He wrote these two. I told a lie without thinking, the cold, muddy road. I told a lie, but the lonely moon rose. I found these haiku in a little book. Oh, I forgot to bring it. The book about the Japanese calligrapher and poet and Zen practitioner Mitsuo Aida. I wanted to show you his calligraphy is a very it's not a refined style. It looks a little childlike, but you can see also he's perfectly capable of doing very elegant formal calligraphy. But he does this kind of free, rough style, typically. And typically, he presents the calligraphy, and then sometimes it's just a single character or a short verse, and then the verse. In this case, it's the Japanese word for lie, uso. And then he gives these two haiku. A short little verse of his own. Tell lies, not to use flattery, not to speak behind people's backs. All precepts I provide. So if you find the precepts of the right speech a challenge, you're in good company. I suspect most of us here can sympathize with him. As a devoted lay practitioner, he probably received the precepts from his Zen teacher in a ceremony called Jukai, receiving the precepts, which 2 weeks from now, six people, let's see, we have Megan and Anne and Miriam and Nirmal and two others are going to do, and they will formally receive the Bodhisattva precepts. So he was well aware of the difficulty of keeping the precepts. Many people who consider taking the step of receiving the precepts formally are hesitant to make that commitment because they know perfectly well how impossible it is to keep the precepts. especially as we become aware more and more of their subtlety. How impossible it is to fulfill our vows completely or perfectly. But the precepts aren't just rules cast in stone. They're a dynamic practice. And that practice gives us a way to deal with our failures and imperfections, which I find of tremendous support. How? First of all, by paying attention. Paying attention to our speech and our actions and their beneficial or harmful effects. Or I should say beneficial and harmful effects, because often it's mixed. Right? Because our motivations get tangled in our best intentions. So first of all, by paying attention. And then when we're aware that we've caused harm, to fully recognize not only that effect, but also all the karmic causes and conditions that led to that speech or action. Not that we can know through generations, we go back, you know, to the origins of humanity, but we see as deeply as we can and know that it goes deeper yet. At our monthly, the precept I mentioned we're going to do a little later, and really at the beginning of the Jukai ceremony, we begin with what's called the verse of purification or the verse of atonement. And many of you know it, all my ancient twisted karma, from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. And that's the other piece. Is we fail repeatedly, and then we look clearly into the deep roots of human suffering. And then we renew our vows. Over and over again, we renew our vows. If you're not familiar with the precepts, as we recite them today, notice that three of them concern right speech. Not lying, not speaking ill of others, and not praising oneself at the expense of others. All concern speech. Or to phrase them in positive terms, speaking truthfully, speaking kindly and modestly. Yeah. So clearly we can cause great suffering with our words, right? Human language is our blessing and our curse. So given that the issue of truth and lies, alternative facts, statements and counterstatements is very much with us and in the air these days, I thought I would concentrate today on that precept of not speaking falsely. What is truth and falsehood anyway? How can we ever really know? Huh? There's an old Zen saying that goes, everything is true, everything is false. We can invert that just as easily and say, nothing is true, nothing is false. And yet, that kind of Zen talk, though it's helpful to knock us out of the ruts of conventional thinking, it also begs the question of how do we true and false, right and wrong, in the world of everyday human life. So let's see if we can get some sense of how that works. None of us likes to think of ourselves as a liar, and we certainly don't like to be accused of being one, do we? Maybe we aren't as quick to confess as the haiku poet Santoka. Maybe because I was brought up on the Christian, Judeo-Christian Ten Commandments,
thou shalt not bear false witness. I was a pretty good little girl, and I didn't really tell that many of those little childhood lies, you know, those little expedient childhood lies that are so tempting, that are called fibs. I was pretty conscientious about not telling lies right through early adulthood. Though, on the other hand, there was a lot I just didn't say. So lying by omission. And we are taught to do that, aren't we? So when I was living in Japan, many years ago now, as a student, and sorting out how to practice right speech in that culture, it was confusing and challenging at times. Because there are a different set of expectations around what you say and don't say. I remember the first time ever lying about my age. I was just over 30, and being 30 was not a big deal at all. That wasn't the issue. But I was attending a Japanese university on a scholarship, and I was older than most of the Japanese students. They wouldn't be in grad school at age 30, you know. Was. And people would assume I was much younger. And they'd ask me, they'd say, "Don't you miss your parents?" And I wouldn't know what to say because I hadn't lived with my parents since I was 17. And I'd been married and owned property. And so I found myself just leaving out large chunks of my but people comfortable with their discomfort. And I just didn't, you know, I was disconcerted by it all. That was falsehood by omission, right? And then one day I was teaching a group of medical school residents English conversation. And they were asking each other how old they were, and they asked me, and I was older than they were, but I wasn't supposed to be. So I just, how do you as they would have expected. And I was shocked at myself. I just lied about my age. In Japan, age, gender, and social position determine the actual grammatical forms of language one uses. The verb ending changes. There are three levels of formality. The one that you use for people. You know, if you're the boss, you use that form you'd use for children, for your employees. In terms of verb endings. There's also different nouns that vary, noun forms depending on formality and gender. Women generally are more polite. So it's very important, and people tend to ask age much earlier in an acquaintance than we do. So it would be that we would... Well, could you turn that off, please, Michael? To adjust to all that. There's an uneasiness when the stable boat of social expectations are rocked, and so I didn't want to rock it, right? And there's a way that in Japanese culture, what we would consider lies are ways of kind of lubricating social interactions to the point that you either avoid telling the truth or you bend it or you even invert it sometimes. Sometimes you do say, you say maybe when you mean no. You say, I'll think about it. And this so, was I lying about my age? Was I lying, or was I using skillful means in a social interaction? Japan, and I no longer, or my personal history to an extent. NBC news anchor named Brian Williams was suspended for 6 months without pay because he had falsely claimed that the helicopter he was riding in while covering the Iraq War 12 years earlier had been under fire and shot down, or had to make it, you know, emergency landing under fire. Now this man had just signed a new contract with NBC for more than $10 million. He was at the top of his game. So what does this suggest about the seductiveness of fame? What one is tempted to get away with? The ease with which one with power and a sense of entitlement can slip into small exaggerations. And this is exactly what happened with him. If they tracked over the 12 years, he began to change his story just a little, and then a little bit more, and then a little bit more, in sort of less formal occasions of telling the story, until and he tells the outright lie. Helicopter was shot down without realizing what he'd done at the time, but out of a habit of inflating his right sounds, but makes a better story as a man of daring and courage, not just one who sits behind the news desk. This temptation, you know, to make a better story can override that ethical imperative. And it's a strong ethical imperative, you know, in journalism, to present the news truthfully. In announcing the suspension, NBC's chief executive said, by his act, usually when someone misremembered version, you know, like if your sister says while, you know, you got that Barbie doll for your birthday, and you think, no, you end your own version, usually pretty strongly, and this is a very strong pattern we have. We even sometimes when presented with factual evidence, we still, and we see this all the time in the public sphere, want to defend our version, right? But he didn't do that. He backed off pretty quickly and admitted his mistake. It's hard to credit that he really believed that his plane had been hit and grounded. He just told that progressively more embellished story. So his mistake was not misremembering, but in misrepresenting what actually happened. And that's what he couldn't confess to. So, I mean, I can't know for sure, but my guess is that the confession itself was tweaked. He tweaked it. It's easier to say I misremembered than I misrepresented. And I misrepresented out of my own self need to self-enhance. Out of that desire for admiration and acclaim. That's what's harder to do. It's harder to really acknowledge our motivations. Years ago, when President Bill Clinton finally admitted to the American public that he had had an inappropriate sexual relationship with his intern, Monica Lewinsky, which he had lied about under oath, by the way, he said he deeply regretted that relationship, but he did not apologize for having lied under oath. Someone at the I found this, you know, I Googled. Feel badly about what I said. That's a great way to deflect. But people feel that when you do, right? I mean, we've been on the receiving end of that. Oh, I'm sorry you feel badly about. Yeah, the trouble is compounded when we lie to ourselves. We Dorothy Wickenton interviews a woman named Sissela Bok, B-O-K. Late 70s, early 70s, in the aftermath of the Vietnam War and the Watergate scandal. In the interview, she says she didn't think there could be it was at that time. And she says, well, you know, I do believe that now we are in a social and political climate of such distrust, and it is connected with lying in many different ways. Now, of course, political lying has a long and colorful history. But Donald Trump trumps most earlier presidential examples in the blatancy and frequency of his lies. Sissela Bok defines lying as knowingly stating a falsehood. Knowingly stating a falsehood. Journalists and the public have been baffled by Donald Trump. Is he deliberately lying? Or does he really convince himself that he believes what he's saying? At least at the time. Bok points out that in Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, he talks about what he calls truthful hyperbole. And he believes in using what he calls truthful hyperbole to tell people what he thinks they want to hear. That whatever is being hyped is the greatest and best. It's the language of the sales pitch, right? Truthful hyperbole. And he believes that such language is actually innocent and fine to use. So we live in a culture of truthful, maybe, hyperbole. When the word awesome is what your server says about your choice of dinner menu, what is there to say when something is truly, deeply awesome? We maintain 100% certainty. Weak and wishy-washy. Bok points out in the interview that when hyperbole strays into vilifying others, it becomes destructive and it perpetuates falsehoods. The interviewer comments that Trump doesn't seem to know the difference. But Bok replies that actually, we don't know if he knows the difference. That people often minimize their sense of responsibility when stretching and bending and manipulating the truth. She identifies three questions we do well to consider when we find ourselves slipping off that balance beam of the truth. What am I doing to myself? What does it do to those around me? And what does it do to the climate of truth around me? What does it do to trust? Sorry, climate of trust. What does it fudge my qualifications on my person. Or I rushed through that email at work and completely forgot to mention preparations for the meeting next week. Versus, I'm a competent, well-organized person. Right? Cognitive dissonance. These are uncomfortable. We can prevent the crash, the harm to ourselves and others. But we have to check ourselves. Self-justifying distorts and oversimplifies reality. It prevents us from seeing the complex, ever-changing interconnectedness of our being. Notice it here, I'm using the language of the Dharma, the perspective of the Dharma. You know, it prevents us from seeing impermanence and our boundless nature, which doesn't need defending. Self-justifying distances us from others and pits us against those we perceive as being different from us. And it makes us mistake phobic. We live in a kind of mistake phobic culture. Mistakes are seen as shameful, a threat to our identity as smart, competent, good people. So there's a tendency to whitewash, deny, and self-justify mistakes in ways that tend to distance us even further from the truth. And this obstructs our ability to take responsibility, right? Responsibility for our speech and actions. And taking responsibility for our speech and actions is exactly what we vow to do when we practice the precepts. Our practice of the precepts must be rooted in our practice of zazen, of meditation. Because that practice is what supports our capacity to hold cognitive dissonance with awareness without reflexively having to relieve it by reverting to fixed views. Right? When we sit. Have you ever noticed cognitive dissonance when we sit? All kinds of arisings come when we sit that are not necessarily congruent with our view of ourselves.
Yeah.
So we have to see them as phenomena, mental phenomena arising and passing. They're conditioned. We let them go. Yeah, so this capacity to practice with our everyday life, speech, and behavior is rooted in our sitting practice. Our very vows, the four bodhisattva vows, which we'll chant at the end of this, with the chant along at the end of this talk, the bodhisattva vows and the precepts evoke cognitive dissonance. Right? They're impossible to accomplish from our narrow self-focus. We fall short of the mark. Again and again, like the poet Ida. But instead of turning to self-justification to ease our discomfort and denial, turning to denial, instead, we turn towards our immediate, our direct experience, the arising of fear, the arising of greed, the arising of clinging to our self-image. And we see it just as it is, and let go. The authors of this book make no claim to Buddhist influence. But they do say that the only antidote to our blind spot when it comes to self-justification is to shed more light on it. They say in the public arena we can improve organizational culture with oversight and incentives for people to be less self-justifying, more self-aware. In our personal lives, they say, this is, I'm quoting them, we can learn to put a little space between what we feel and how we respond. Insert a moment of reflection. That sounds pretty much like what we do in our practice, right? We take the backward step and shine the light of awareness into the shadows of our heart and mind. We see into the impermanence and the conditioned nature of reality. And this insight informs us that all our precious knowledge that we want to try and hang on to and convince others of is always, always partial and always provisional. Anytime you're feeling stuck in a belief, you know, and you're butting heads with somebody else who has a different one, just say to yourself, this belief is partial. This belief that I think is so important is partial, and it's provisional. It's always subject to evolving and becoming a bigger belief, a bigger view. Not a belief, a bigger, more spacious view. And that's what our practice supports us to have, is a bigger, more spacious view. And with the spaciousness, we can go forward with a sense of confidence that's tempered by humility, and an energy that's balanced with patience, and wisdom that's balanced by compassion. I thought I would close with the two quotes that they open the book with. The first one's by George Orwell, British essayist, novelist. He wrote it in 1946, just after World War II. He says, "We are all capable of believing things which we know to be untrue, and then, when we are finally proved wrong, impudently twisting the facts so as to show that we were right. Intellectually, it's possible to carry on this process for an indefinite time. The only check on it is that sooner or later, a false belief bumps up against solid reality, usually on a battlefield." And then the second quote is from Lao Tzu, so that's 2,500 years ago, that he would have We don't even know if Lao Tzu is a person, right? It's sort of a yeah, and then in a little bit we'll chant the precepts together as well. Thank you, everyone.